Thank you for tuning in to Hacks and Hobbies with your host, Junaid. We're visited by our amazing guests coming from all walks of life. We want to learn their story, their struggles, and their journey on how they got to where they are today. So stick around. What does it really mean to tell stories responsibly? Especially when those stories hold someone else's pain. Today's guest has trained thousands on how to tell stories that inspire change without causing harm. Welcome back to Hacks and Hobbies. I'm your host, Junaid Ahmed, and today we're exploring storytelling, but not the kind you'll hear in a marketing course. Our guest, Maria Bryan, is a trauma-informed storytelling trainer and host of the When Bearing Witness podcast. She works with nonprofits, public sector leaders, and change makers to ensure their stories resist exploitation, honor dignity, and create real impact. Maria, I've been looking forward to this one. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Junaid. It's such a joy and honor to be here. Thanks so much for having me on.
100%. Let's start with the basics. What is trauma-informed storytelling, and how is it different than traditional storytelling or content marketing?
Right. So when we ask people to tell their stories, they're digging back. And let me first lay some foundation on whose stories I'm typically supporting to tell. And this is for nonprofit fundraising and marketing. So we have folks that are coming to our doors because they have a problem. Their problem might be housing, substance abuse, trafficking. It could be food insecurity. It could just be even an after-school program. It doesn't even have to be what we consider high trauma. But they definitely have a problem to solve. So traditionally in nonprofit storytelling, what we're doing is through the story showing that how we solved their problem through our mission and our services. So this is what we've been taught in traditional fundraising and storytelling. So my aha moment was we're asking people to dig deep into the most painful, traumatic seasons of their life.
Yeah.
And to share that story. And I know that these stories are important. So I don't preach to throw stories out the window, but how can we hold space for folks to revisit these really painful experiences in a way that promotes safety and resists harm for them? We can't promise safety. We can't promise that we won't do harm, but we can at least acknowledge that they're doing something very difficult and painful. And throughout the whole storytelling process, we can honor and respect that trauma and do things to mitigate re-traumatization coming up.
Wow, that's definitely a better way than bringing that trauma up, because they've worked so hard to try to overcome the trauma, and then you're bringing these stories back up that we don't want that to happen.
Exactly. And, you know, typically in the nonprofit space, I'll always ask folks in my training, how many stories are you telling a year? And people are telling hundreds of stories. I mean, some folks are like, oh, we're only telling a few, but a lot of nonprofit storytellers are telling dozens, if not hundreds of stories a year. And so they're asking dozens, if not hundreds of people in a very short period of span to tell their stories. And so that's just not giving enough buffer for trauma-informed processes. So I'm really foundationally trying to help folks unlearn things like we need to tell 100 stories a year, right? It really honestly starts with that. Let's just slow things down. Let's tell less news stories. You need to talk about marketing. And we learn a lot in the for-profit space about repurposing content. But for some reason in the nonprofit space, we've been taught that we're newscasters, that we have to tell new, fresh stories all the time to show our supporters through fundraising what impact that they're having for their dollars to encourage them to retain them. And so I'm trying to you know, kind of put that on its head and say, hey, we don't need to do that. And here's the reason. It can cause a lot of harm for our communities and the peoples that we serve. Also, marketing best practices. We can repurpose content. We can tell different kinds of stories, and we can tell stories in a different way, like anonymously, composite storytelling. And I can unpack those tactics that still have a huge impact, raise a ton of money, and are more protective of what I call our story owners.
I love that. What have been some common ways storytelling is unintentionally causing harm? Because as these nonprofit are telling these stories, hundreds of stories, kind of also showing progress, I guess, but then they're also then not doing a service or doing a disservice to all the stories that are being told.
So there's a lot of tenets, pillars of being trauma-informed. There's two I want to highlight. One is providing safety and agency. When you're experiencing trauma, that's stripped away. You don't feel safe. You're not in control. So I think of all the times that we actually continue to remove safety and agency during the storytelling process. So what I want to do is insert that back. So simple things, like sometimes we don't even give choices to folks on how they tell their story. We have very specific questions in mind and a very specific arc in mind that might not actually be very respectful and not give them that much autonomy. So bringing them in and saying, okay, these are our goals with this story. What are your goals with this story? This sounds simple, but this blows marketers' minds because they don't take that simple, and it is simple, but it's still an added part of the storytelling process of not just coming to the story owner and say, I want to tell your story, but being very clear. I want to tell this story to use as testimony for advocacy or for our gala to fundraise or to encourage more community members to join our program. It's usually one of those. And I say, that's what I want to do with this. It's likely going to come up in our newsletter. It might be a video that we show at our event. What are your goals for telling your story? And then see, like, is there a Venn diagram? Do they align? Before we even get to the story. And then during the whole interview process, there's lots of things we can do. Are you comfortable with a video staff here with like five people here, right? Or do we want as less people as possible? Would you prefer someone with similar lived experiences than you to interview you? Would you prefer a male or a female? Some of this makes a big difference. Let's say if someone's telling this story of domestic violence or sexual assault, that might really be triggering to have someone who had that same gender identity interviewing them and then digging into this, deep history. Sometimes we ask people to come to us, and that can be really uncomfortable. Why don't we come to them? And that's just the beginning. That's just the story gathering part of it. One of the less sexy parts that I think is really important, once someone has told their story, and then we publish it. And again, go back to the fact that sometimes folks are telling dozens to 100 stories a year, right? And they get just little things wrong, maybe gender pronoun, maybe the name of their daughter, maybe the name of the hospital, or some key thing that you might, as a storyteller, not think is significant. This is a huge breach of trust because this person has bravely shared their story with you and not taking the time to fact check or have them review the story. How absolutely re-traumatizing and triggering for them to read this and be like, they got my name wrong. That's not my how I spell my name or pronounce my name. Again, the less sexy parts, like making sure they're part of the review process. So I really have taken what I did in my career. My background is in journalism. I was in marketing for many, many years in the nonprofit sector. When this idea of trauma-informed storytelling kind of landed on my lap, I had a student ask me about it. I spent 2 years and continue to be in deep study of trauma and what it means to be trauma-informed. And so I'm constantly analyzing the storytelling process and how we can, every step of the way, strive to give safety and agency. And I've just talked about the story owner. So when you're ready, it's more than the story owner. It's actually
Absolutely.
your audiences too, and even ourselves. There's a way that we can honor trauma and mitigate re-traumatization or vicarious trauma for all who are impacted by story.
Wow, that's so deep in so many different ways. You know, having that intentionality of what is the story going to serve the purpose for the company and for the story owner, as well as the teller, as well as who are the audiences or where are they receiving this story? Like all of those things, right. It's really good to have that before you even start telling the story or capturing the story. Now, what kind of aha moments do people have when they go through your certification program or, you know, even discovering the process that you work with them?
It's very painful to unlearn. Folks that are in the nonprofit space, and I work with both social enterprises and those that work directly in nonprofit spaces, and we're here to mitigate harm. We're here to make the world a better place. So I have to first say they experience a lot of shame and guilt. That's just the reality. Mm-hmm. And so I'll let's just put like a pin in that because it's part of the process is addressing the shame and guilt. So there's just some of the aha moments. We start with just understanding trauma. I don't know how many of your listeners are outside the United States, but inside the United States, it's worldwide, but we have studies to show the correlation between trauma and severe health consequences later in life, within the leading causes of death. So things like cancer, things that would surprise you, like obesity and asthma, can be correlated to unresolved trauma. So that's a wake up call. Like this is a big deal. You know, this is a really big deal that we need to be mitigating re-traumatization and vicarious trauma. But then the good news is I try to give as many tools as possible. So support in actual systems and protocols that support to be trauma informed, starting from story readiness all the way down to story retraction, which can happen 10 years later, and including a harm repair plan. So you have a plan for when you're human and when you mess up. So storytellers kind of go through that process of auditing their storytelling process and saying, oh, these are more trauma-informed interview questions, or this is a different way we can go about story readiness, or, oh, maybe there's more people that should be part of our review team than just me and the development director. And so we go through the tactical of, like I said, understanding trauma, what we can do, how we can do things differently. Yeah. And then this is where we can go back to that pin, is we address the shame and guilt and kind of let that go and move on. And with doing that, learn how to give yourself grace. That's where the harm repair plan comes in, where it's like, okay, we know to have a crisis plan. Many marketers, communication specialists are familiar with crisis communications planning, but not necessarily with the harm repair plan. So they have an understanding of it. So they can adapt to it pretty quickly. And then, you know, with accepting what you might have done to cause harm, I obviously ask folks to have grace for folks in their organization that are not ready, that are at a different part of their journey. And then a big part of my work is organizational change. And really, to me, this is a movement, because if you just train 1,000 middle managers, which is what I've done, you're not going to change the sector and how we tell stories. Then from there, you have to give them tools to lead with this and to have hard conversations within their communities and within their organizations.
That's absolutely powerful, because it gives them the right tools, it gives them the right training, so that they can interact with other humans who have gone through these experiences in a much more empathetic manner. Now, for those of us who interview others or gather testimonials, you know, as podcast hosts, as interviewers of all sorts of things, those stakes are even higher, because we're gathering these stories. We want to make sure that we're gathering these stories ethically. We're not re-traumatizing somebody by going over these stories or going over these experiences. So let's talk about how we can do that.
Yeah, you know, I could point to a few things that were part of my experience being on this interview that were really impressive to me. As one is, you know, when people understand what's to come, that's part of giving them safety and agency. So we met first, so we got to know each other. So this is not our first conversation. That's really important because oftentimes story owners, they've worked with the program staff and they're like, oh, who's this marketer talking to me? Like the first time they're talking to them, they're unloading their story. So having a touch point that's before, you know, the interview, as podcasters is really, really important. And then I got a number of emails on what to expect, you know, so I knew before this interview, exactly what was going to take place. And so that's something that podcasters can do, whether it's sharing interview questions ahead of time, just saying like, listen, this is going to be both video and recording, giving tips on how they can prepare. Another really important thing is people can be really nervous when they're being interviewed for a podcast. I was a little nervous and I do this for, I have a podcast. Sinead like immediately was like, okay, we gotta do some tech checks and it can be a little nerve-wracking. So one thing that you did also that was very trauma-informed was just not jumping into the interview, but just having a human connection, asking how someone is, finding just that touch point that's neutral, that's not necessarily gonna dig deep. And that just brings people to their present, that grounds folks. Something to do at the end too. Sometimes at the end of the interview, it's like, okay, thanks, bye. But folks might have brought up stuff that's more painful than you think, that they might have grudged up stuff they haven't thought about for a long time. So at the end of the interview, to just give a moment to say, like, how did that feel? How did that go? And then maybe bring the conversation down to something lighter or neutral. So you when you send someone back into the world, that they're hopefully feeling a little bit more grounded. If you recognize during the interview that someone has told a difficult story, I think it's fair after the interview to acknowledge that. Say, thank you. You shared this, you know, really powerful and maybe painful childhood story or story about your marriage or child or whatever it may be. And I just want to say that I hope you take some time to ground yourself today. So, you know, these are simple things that we can do before, during, and after that just again, it all comes back to safety and agency. What makes folks feel safe? And we can't promise that, but we can provide, you know, at least provide choices. And then, of course, the agency and autonomy. And then again, not everyone, you know, I can't imagine if I had everyone reviewing the podcast that I send, but some people ask, like, it felt like a dream, that interview. I don't remember anything I said, and I'm worried that I said something weird. Can I review it before? And I'll always say yes and let them review it. And this is something that I'll see on kind of like podcast groups or chats, and that is someone asked to take down a podcast interview because they don't want their story out there anymore, or they got a new job. What should I do? And this should just be a rule across the board with podcasting. No questions asked. If someone wants their episode removed, remove it. Just remove it. And like, yes, we do get have things signed and yes, it's good to have, you know, media consent forms and things like that. But the courage that it took for them to ask that was a
Amen.
journey. And so it really, it's painful to me to read those chats because that journey for them, for the podcast owner, starts when they get that request, but they don't realize that probably took weeks for that person to listen
Before
to
they
it.
even ask,
Right, to realize it didn't land, the anxiety that they felt, the stress, and even the waiting game on whether or not they're going to take down the podcast. Just honor it. There's a reason, there's a significant reason, likely someone wants that episode taken down. I think sometimes this is very difficult to do in podcasting. In written form, sometimes asking, well, can we make this anonymous or something like that might be, but really, I don't even like negotiating. If someone is asking to retract their story, it is their story. And that's why I call them the story owner, not the storyteller. They're the story owner. Junaid,
Love
you're the
that.
storyteller. You're helping tell
Yes.
my story. I'm telling you my story. And then you are sharing that on all of your platforms, likely, right? So you're the storyteller. I've given you my story to tell broadly and widely. And that is a huge role and responsibility and a sacred one.
Maria, I had never thought about it from this view at all. Like, I thought that the storytelling that I was doing was my own stories, right? But I am retelling the story that you're sharing, right, through different forms, through articles, through blog posts, what have you. And it's a really powerful realization, because as podcasting becomes more and more mainstream, we're literally listening to these stories from the storyteller's mouth, and hoping that they have the approval and the sign off from the story that they're sharing.
Exactly. And that's another part of our workflows. We assume a lot. You know, we assume there's consent. We assume, and I can't believe I didn't touch on consent because consent is such a huge part of this too, how we
It's the
tell
first.
stories secondhand, and or the story owner will think that it's ending up one place and then we repurpose it for the next 20 years and they're like, whoa, I'm on a billboard. How do I get on a billboard? So yeah.
Maria, when an organization wants to highlight a person's stories, what steps should they take to ensure that it's trauma informed as well? I mean, you shared a lot of the things that podcasters already do, or what I did, and thank you so much for bringing that up. Appreciate it. It took me a while learning experience over time to, what would make my guests feel comfortable in sharing their story. But what about organizations? What are some of the things that they should do to take the steps and make sure that they are trauma-informed as well?
You know, it needs to be really clear what everybody's role is. And for a long time, it was just really the role of the marketer or the fundraiser. It kind of felt like the buck started and stopped there. But everyone should play a role. And again, this is why I think when folks are like, oh, I only tell three new stories a year, I'm like, kudos, keep doing that. Because when you're only telling three new stories a year as an organization, that's going to give you so much room to involve more people. Maybe not every single micro story, but the bigger stories that you're telling, the gala video that you're showing, or in my world, at the end of the year, we do the most of our fundraising. So we'll usually do a really big campaign that centers on one to three stories. So all those processes that I gave on how we interact with the story owner, who's involved in that? So when we're talking about story readiness, what program staff or social workers can point us to folks that they think are emotionally ready to tell their story? When it comes to the interview, who in our organization might want to be present to advocate for them? This is really, really important. And I love when organizations have advocates that will be present during interview just to make sure they're not asking the questions. They're just there to just kind of mitigate, just to make sure that the person is feeling safe. They're looking for those signs that they might be uncomfortable. Review process. Now, sometimes it's a lot asking the story owner to review, right? We should offer it to them, but it might be some difficult. And so if they are not able to review it, who can review that story? One of my first nonprofit jobs was at Charles B. Wong Community Health Center. This was a health center in New York City, both in Chinatown, Manhattan, and Queens, New York. I'm a white woman. If you're listening to this, I'm a white woman working in a Chinese organization, right? I speak and read English really well, not the case with, Chinese and Mandarin, et cetera, Cantonese. So, I really kind of went through this boot camp of trauma-informed storytelling, not even knowing it, because I had to rely on so many people in this organization. Everything from, is this culturally appropriate? Is this health literate? So let's just say you're in a health organization. After you've written your story, is there a health professional that can read this, that can kind of like fact check it from a health perspective? Is there someone in the organization that can give a cultural review? we would have senior volunteers that would review all of our help materials.
Yeah.
That was kind of how they gave back, just to make sure. We'd say, like, from your perspective, do you understand this? Does it make sense? So who in your community can read these stories or these
Yeah.
materials and give their feedback? And then leadership sign-off, leadership who are kind of setting the tone for the values and the mission of the organization can maybe pick up on some blind spots in the story. So a lot of folks in your organization should be involved in this process. So that means educating them on what it means to be trauma-informed and what their role is, and then getting it on paper, like actually on paper. These are the different parts of the storytelling process. And Sue is going to do this, and Jim is going to do this, and Junaid is going to do this, and Maria will do this. And then we decide, okay, what's our capacity? Maybe our capacity is to do 100 stories a year. And there are nonprofits that have that capacity. And then smaller shops who are trying to keep up with the big ones think that they have to do that. But if you get it all on paper, maybe you're like, okay, we're just going to tell one story a quarter. That's what we have the capacity, so that we're truly from beginning to end being trauma informed and involving a number of people to, again, just kind of checks and balances to make sure that we're doing this in a way that's trauma informed.
Wow, that's such detail, such attention to detail, as well as the empathy that goes along with the whole process. I think it's really well thought out, and wow. I love it. Now, Maria, what role does a storyteller agency play in ethical storytelling? Because after they've, you know, gotten all of these things signed off, you know, everybody's on the journey, but now it's their ethical duty to deliver the story.
But I love that you brought that up, because through the When Bearing Witness program, where I bring folks on this journey, 40% are agency owners and consultants that aren't working directly in organizations. And it's very different, because you can develop now this trauma-informed practice. And I'll give a little bit of an example, because I've worked in a few agencies as well, where, you know, I've gone in and they're like, oh, the patient that we expected to tell their story wasn't available, so we grabbed this person and they're going to tell their story. And that's a funny position to put me in, because I know that's not trauma informed. We skipped a huge part of this by just grabbing someone in the patient waiting room to tell their story. So, you know, as a storytelling agency, I think it's important for your team to understand, and then not to necessarily, you can't force other organizations to do this. You also can't force your own organization to do this. This is the reality. What you can do is model it with a lot of grace and dignity. Do you mind if I have a 20-minute conversation with him just to gauge if he's ready? So not say, no, we're absolutely not interviewing this person, but just to model what it might look like to do this in a trauma-informed way. I would also love to see more storytelling agencies put together policies that their organizations might want to adopt. Hey, I notice you don't have a media consent form. Here's one that you can adopt and use. So to kind of have a toolkit. I noticed that you're kind of a one-man person. Like, is there a social worker on your team that can be part of this process? Here's a workflow template that we like to share with our organizations. So we do a lot of work in agencies to onboard our clients, and I would love to see kind of like a trauma-informed toolkit be part of that onboarding materials.
That's genius. I mean, having the right tools, the right communication, so that the person that you're just pulling off is well-informed, he's trauma-informed, and they've given their consent. They're you know, making sure that they're not forced out of, you know, out of an expectation to, hey, you got to do this interview or else.
Exactly. Which people will feel. Here's the reality. This particular organization was a federally qualified health center, meaning this person was receiving free services. So when you're going to someone who is providing free services and say, hey, we have a whole video agency here, we need someone, can you tell their story? I mean, talk about like trauma responses, you know, like one trauma response that people have, it's a little bit less studied, but it's really important. So we talk a lot about the fight, flight, freeze, right? But then there's this behavioral fawn response where you want to please and appease. That's your trauma response. So often we think that when people are quick to say yes, that they're doing so from a place of consent and agency, when really it's this fawn response. If you are providing them services, there is a power dynamic at play.
Yeah.
So people are going to say yes because they're afraid that you're going to disappoint them. They're going to take their services away, right? So yes, yeah, there's that we really have to dig deeper and think thoughtfully about the dynamic between an organization, the dynamics between an organization, story owners, and also the dynamic between storytelling agencies and organizations and social enterprises. It's tricky. This is not easy work.
No.
This is not easy work. And I have to say, I study it and I teach it. And after I hold storytelling circles, and I encourage anyone listening to this that's interested, these are free monthly circles that I have. It's 1 hour, it's unrecorded. And we just talk about the messiest, complicated, nuanced part of trauma-informed storytelling.
Wow.
And so I encourage you to come. One, you'll see me model to the best that I can being trauma-informed. But at the end, I always just take a moment to share love and gratitude, because the folks in the circle and my students are actually doing the work. I'm teaching it, but they're doing it. They're having the difficult, messy conversations and doing the work of overhauling their protocols and their workflows. So I have just so much respect for nonprofit storytellers who are taking this on in a huge way, because it is, we always say being trauma-informed is a journey, not a destination. Mm-hmm. And that is the absolute truth.
Maria, this is awesome. And this is really beautiful. And what's cool is that it leads perfectly into what we'll be diving into part two of this episode, how to embed trauma-informed practices into organizational culture and campaigns. Maria, you've given us so much to reflect on. In our next episode, we're going to go deeper into how to build a trauma-informed communication teams, why storytelling isn't about extraction and it's about collaboration, and how can story heal when told with care. So thank you so much. All right, guys, make sure you're subscribed and following, and don't miss the next episode. We'll see you again here on Hacks and Hobbies.
Congratulations, you made it to the end of the episode. Thanks so much for listening to our guest on this episode. Please send me an email at Junaid@hacksandhobbies.com to tell me what you loved about our guest today. You could find links mentioned in this episode on the hacksandhobbies.com website.